Welcome to Hollywood Wolfpack with Kaya Alexander, featuring in-depth interviews and insights with professionals in the entertainment business. Get everything you need to navigate your above-the-line career right here. This podcast is often recorded live in front of Kaya students in the Entertainment Business School. You can find out more at entertainmentbusinessschool.com. Hollywood Wolfpack is the new face of entertainment business wisdom. Enjoy the show.
Hi, and welcome to the show. I am Kaya Alexander, stoked to be here today with my special guest, writer Joe Russo. Let me tell you about Joe. He's awesome. He is a cinephile, horror fan, pizza lover, and filmmaker. Joe is a three-time Bloodlist screenwriter whose recent feature film credits include the Mickey Rourke starring horror anthology Nightmare Cinema, the Lifetime thriller The Au Pair Nightmare, the Bruce Willis starring Hard Kill, the Ryan Phillippe, Phillippe, and Ving Rhames and Kate Bosworth starring The Locksmith, and the Zac Efron, Russell Crowe starring The Greatest Beer Run Ever. He's also the producer of the critically acclaimed horror podcast Postmortem with Mick Garris. Joe in the house.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I know, are your feet blistered? You're off, straight off the picket line coming to us here this afternoon.
I you can definitely tell my face is a little red. I forgot my sunscreen today.
Did you get rained on too? We've had monsoons.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Crazy here in Southern California.
We had rain yesterday and this morning, but we picketed through it. We're on strike.
Yes.
Yeah. Burn Hollywood, burn it down.
Hey, where'd you go pick it?
So I am stationed at CBS Television City, which is kind of in the Mid-Wilshire Miracle Mile area.
Yes.
And there I will live until this is over, because I am a Writers Guild captain, and I maybe foolishly volunteered to be a assistant gate coordinator, which means that that is my lot, and I will be there every morning until the strike is resolved.
I would love to hear more about the strategy, both behind picketing and the strike and what's happening, and also your particular strategy as writers with picket signs on site.
Sure. Yeah. So the idea with picketing, obviously, is to create awareness. You know, it's visible. People see it. People see it driving by. People see the signs. You know, I think especially in the era of social media, which, you know, the last strike in 2007 was just a little before the curve on that. You know, I think it's very visible now. I think this week you've probably seen it too. There's tons and tons of photos and videos flooding Twitter and Instagram and TikTok. And it's been really great to see kind of the solidarity and how many people have our back. And so it's about creating visibility, obviously. And then it's also just to, you know, kind of annoy the shit out of the people who have to go in and out of the studio gates. you know, we definitely have had, oh man, there was this one lady yesterday. She pulled too far into the intersection trying to take left into CBS, and she got stuck at a, you know, at the intersection. The light just wasn't changing for some reason. I think she like drove past the signals, and she probably got stuck trying to take a left for 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
We were just marching through the intersection, preventing her from turning.
There you go. And
yeah, so you know, they gave me a megaphone, so
woo-hoo!
It was just fun, and you know, I was basically saying, you know, hey, tell your bosses to make a deal and we'll go away, you know, like. But so yeah, there's you know, it's a combination of visibility, and I think just like showing the world that like we are pencils down, we're not writing right now, we're out there fighting for our careers and for future screenwriters' careers.
That's a beautiful thing. It's my hope too, echoing what you've just said, that this actually does reach the consumers who really follow stars or celebrities or actors more than they really understand writers and writers' names that go into the creation of the shows and the films that they love so much. Do you feel like we're getting more penetration?
I mean, I think writers will always have like third visibility behind directors and stars, you know, but I feel a lot of support. I feel a lot of, you know, there's been a lot more on social media, people saying, go get them, you know, get the money, than there have been people saying, go get a real job. So, which there have been plenty of those too. And weirdly, they all have Elon Musk's blue checks after their name. It's been good. You know, I think the writers are feeling the love right now, which is good and important, because what we're doing is not easy.
Speaking of the negotiation and some of the points that were brought up to the WGA and where the negotiations fell apart, were you surprised at all to see the things that the studios refused to negotiate on? There were a few of these points, including AI being one of them.
Yeah, I was, I've been thinking there was going to be a strike pretty much for the last several months. I was not someone who thought there was going to be a deal, but what I was surprised about when the WGA showed their proposals and what the studios countered with, which I thought was a brilliant thing to release that publicly. I think it's super helpful so everyone can really see how bad things are with the studios right now. It was further apart than I could have ever imagined. And the fact that they're not engaging with us on things like free work, or things like artificial intelligence, is really, really concerning.
Yes.
It shows you where they want to take things.
For some of my listeners who might not be as familiar with free work, we're recording this live in front of some of my students at the Entertainment Business School who know a bit more about the free work that is sometimes expected of writers at so many stages of the creation process. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of pressure for free work across all spectrums of screenwriting. My career has mostly been focused on feature screenwriting, so I can't speak to the TV side of the free work so much. But, you know, usually when you're initially developing things with producers, there's expectations of, you know, when you're going to develop a pitch for free, and then they might give you notes on that pitch, and then they might give you notes again before they put it in front of their boss or before they put it in front of the studio. So you're doing all of these rewrites on an extensive story document before you even get the chance to even get a job. You know, that's a big problem. And then, you know, once you're, let's say you get the job and you're lucky enough to do that, a lot of writers are only getting, you know, one-step deals where they write the thing and the producers look at it and say, oh gosh, we don't want to give this to the buyer yet until we think it's absolutely perfect. Why don't you do some notes? Oh no, why don't you do some more notes? Why don't you do some more notes? And then you end up in this cycle where they're blocking the material from going to the studio because, you know, they're trying to make sure it moves ahead, yes. But in doing so, they're basically grinding the screenwriter's fee, which is usually split into an upfront and a delivery payment, half and half.
Yes.
Holding that second piece back to the point where it devalues it to almost nothing.
Right. Especially new producer comes on. Oh, another round of notes. New producer came on the project. Yeah. And it's like when the horizon keeps moving and you're chasing it, when do you finally, you know, get to stop? So that was one of the pieces that was up for the negotiation.
Yeah, we were trying to build in two-step deals so that we have, you know, additional rewrites built in so that it takes the pressure off of the producer and the writer to deliver a first draft. And we really can actually collaborate with the studio and the producer to shape the script in the way they want it to go.
How is that similar or different to an if-come deal?
Well, I mean, an if come deal is more like you're teaming up with a producer and you'll develop either from scratch or maybe you've already got a spec that they're developing with you. The idea is eventually they're going to take it to market, right? And if they sell it, then you will get paid for it, right? It's if you sell it, then money will come, if come, right? So, you know, you're still doing free work essentially in an if come situation, but that's more like, I think, early stage development. When the free work that they're trying to negotiate with the studios on more so is this, once you set up a project with a buyer, how do you ensure that there are steps built into your contract that lets you deliver a script, get paid, get their notes, do a rewrite, deliver it, get paid again, and make sure that it's not stretched out into an unreasonable time frame.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. What do you feel are the most important elements for our listeners to understand about the writer's strike?
I think the thing that people don't understand on the outside looking in is, I think people think Hollywood, there's lots of money, you know, and yes, there are some screenwriters who have very, very big overall deals with studios, but like that is the very, very few exception to the rule. The rule is you've got a lot of working class screenwriters. You know, if you make $100,000 on a deal per se, right, and you've got an agent, manager, and lawyer, you're taking 25% out of that $100,000 right off the top. You also have to take another 20% out for taxes.
Yeah.
So now you're looking at like just over $50,000 left, right? And if you have a writing partner like I do, you have to cut that in half. And so $100,000 deal doesn't sound so good when you look at it that way. And then if you are doing a bunch of free work and it's stretching out the time frame you're working on that one project, that, you know, $25,000 to $50,000 gets stretched even further.
Right. Like this isn't like salary. You're not guaranteed to make that again next year, right?
Exactly. You have to then go find another job. You have to go sell another screenplay. You have to get hired for an open writing assignment. And there's no guarantee of that at all. So that money that you make on that project may have to last you 6 months to 2 years before you can do it again, you know? So lots of screenwriters have had to get second jobs, start side businesses, do little gig hustles, you know, just to like help support the fact that they're making movies or television shows for some of the richest companies in the world. And that's the big thing that the Writers Guild is trying to fight against. All of the heads of the companies paid themselves bonuses last year that totals in the amount more than what the Guild is asking for 3 more years.
But just the bonuses total.
Yeah, and this is like 8 people that we're talking about versus thousands of writers.
Versus thousands of writers. Yeah, these CEOs are pulling in 9 figures, 10 figures in some cases, if you add in the stock options
David Zaslav made $250 million last year, one person. And that's about half of what the Guild's asking for.
Yeah, and this is the guy who killed Batgirl to do it. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And then gave himself a massive bonus in exchange.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yeah. The inequity is, it's astonishing. I mean, you look at the actual figures and the way that it breaks down. I hope that the strike really does raise awareness, you know, amongst everyone. I feel like it'll put more pressure on these companies to do the right thing if there's a lot more awareness around it.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you, how soon do you think this could be resolved?
That's the magic question, isn't it? You know, we had a really great meeting with the guild membership as of this recording this past Wednesday night on day two of the strike. And the big surprise that happened at that meeting was the heads of all of the labor unions were there at the WGA meeting. And that's really significant because it's never happened before. So historically,
wow.
Huge precedent. And we've never really gotten the guilds together in a way where we could work together. And the Directors Guild and SAG's contract are being renegotiated over the next few weeks. Those two agreements expire June 30th. So there is a world where if we continue to link arms with all the guilds and the AMPTP, which is the group that represents all of the studios, if they don't come and make a deal with us and with them by June 30th, there's a world where all production, all writing shuts down. Hollywood will literally stop. And that is a reality that is getting closer and closer by the minute.
Wow. I know 15 years ago, it cost California about $2 billion.
And that was just with the writers striking. Imagine what happens when, imagine what happens when everything shuts down. Mm. And my hope is if that does come to pass and that happens, it will force the studios back to the table in a meaningful way. And that it will get resolved fairly quickly in short order after that.
Yeah, right now they've got the golden goose, right? Just keep laying, you know, and we'll keep cashing in. And it's just astounding the apathy that has come down the pike, you know, even at the earnings call from Warner Discovery, which was this week, which is like, yeah, we're on track to be profitable, you know, to the tunes of many billions of dollars on the backs of hardworking people.
Well, and the reality is they all took stock baths this week. They all lost a lot of value this week. And that's just in the first couple of days of the strike. Imagine this stretching on. Imagine what happens when SAG and the DGA strike as well. They will have to come to the table because they will be hemorrhaging money at the stock market. So that's the goal, is to just keep applying these pain pressures until they give us a deal that is reasonable, that takes into account some of these things that they literally just ignored in our proposals.
For my listeners who are not in the major hubs, Los Angeles, New York, how can they help?
That's a great question. Obviously social media, tweeting at the studios, telling them, you know, that they want them to make a fair deal for the writers, that they want this to be resolved. That helps, you know, whatever you can do in solidarity for the writers is great. The Writers Guild has set up a fund, which I believe you can find on their WGAstrike.org website. And on it, It's like, it used to be called the Actors Fund. I think it's called like the Entertainment Fund now, but you can make donations to that. And that is money that can be used not just by screenwriters to get them through the strike, but it's also for anyone, actors, craftspeople below the line. Anyone who is struggling from the strike can have access to this fund and apply for money from it. So that's a huge, you know, making a donation to that, I think, would help the fight for sure. If you're not nearby. And, you know, I think the guild is working on, you know, maybe some strategies about potential boycotts and things. So like kind of maybe keep an eye out for that in case, you know, we need to mobilize, but you know, that might be a little bit further down the road.
That's really, really helpful. Well, let's go back a little bit in time. Let's talk a little bit more about you. How did you get into show business? How did you fall in love with this profession?
Well, I grew up in Connecticut, which is almost as far away from Los Angeles as you can get. And so I never really considered making movies as a viable career. You know, if we don't win this strike, it might not be still. I grew up loving movies. My parents weren't really sports people. They were arts people. And so they instilled in me a deep love of movies from an early age. But it wasn't until I got into college that I really started to be like, oh, you know, this is a job and a career you can have. And I can go transition into the film school and, you know, get my degree in this. And so that's kind of where the bug really bit me. And I ended up working production for several years as a crew member in various different departments, in productions in Arizona, you know, feature films, reality TV, commercials, industrials, all sorts of different things, all sorts of different positions. I really learned all the departments, what they do, how to talk to a crew, which has been super helpful for down the road. And then I was living in Arizona at the time. There was a state tax incentive. It went away. And so did all the work.
Oh, no.
So my dream of Arizona becoming like a you know, an Austin, Texas kind of, you know, offshoots of Hollywood type of thing quickly dried up. And I said to my wife, I was like, I have to go to Los Angeles. And she said, that's fine. But until you have a steady job, you're coming home every weekend. So I started driving back and forth between Phoenix and LA, which is
it's like 8 hours, isn't it?
Yeah, with traffic, it can be. Yeah. Yeah. Like 6.5 on a you know, straight shot. I managed to get an internship out here, and I just directed a short that was playing the festivals circuit, and I directed another short that summer while I was interning, and I somehow by the end of my internship wrangled a meeting with the CEO of the company. He had produced a lot of 90s movies like X-Men and Wild Wild West, and he watched the shorts and said, you've got the talent, you've got the entrepreneurial spirit, you don't know anyone, you don't know how the industry works, come work for me. So I became his assistant. And, you know, I was his assistant for a couple of years. And then I moved into the development side of things. I worked as a creative exec and then director of development through basically 2015 at the company.
I was a development exec as well, so we share that in common.
I've noticed that from your Twitter bio and such. So you know, I like that I have had that experience. I enjoyed being a development exec. I liked working with writers, but you know, most of the writers I worked hand in hand with, I think, really liked working with me because I gave them great notes, because I secretly was becoming a writer, right? By 2015, we had a pilot that we wrote that got set up with Will Smith's company. And that was when I was really like, maybe I should be putting more, you know, time into my screenwriting. And so I left that job in 2015. I consulted as a development exec for Christina Aguilera's company for 2 years. But really, I was trying to get my writing career going during that time. You know, we got our first manager in 2015, signed with Gersh in 2016. That year we got on this thing called the Bloodlist, which is the best horror scripts of the year.
Yes.
And then we three-peated that with new specs every year. And I had my first movie go into production in 2017 as a producer. So that's kind of how I got to the dance.
You've had a lot of really interesting projects. Tell us a story from one of your favorite films getting made.
Oh my gosh, that's broad. Well, you know, I guess just going chronologically, you know, the first one that I produced, Nightmare Cinema, was interesting because it was a horror anthology. So it's five different stories kind of combined into one feature. But what was really great about that one was, you know, there were five different directors, and they were all really established horror directors like Joe Dante, who directed Gremlins, and David Slade, who's hot off the Hannibal TV series. And, you know, so I got to watch five really distinctive filmmakers from the horror space with a lot of experience under their belt. And I got to be there every day on sets, and I got to sit by the monitor with them and watch what they were doing, and, you know, watched how they dealt with the crews and how they dealt with the actors. And it was just, you know, film school is great, but like it was the best graduate school for actual filmmaking that I could ever have hoped for.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool.
Are you also directing?
So I did direct a movie. It's called The Au Pair Nightmare. It was a thriller that was on Lifetime in 2020, right in the heart of the pandemic. We went and we shot that movie in 2019, out in New Mexico. We had almost no money and 14 days to make it. But it turned out, it was intense. But, you know, I really think I would not have been able to do it had I not just had that experience on Nightmare Cinema and watched those guys. You know, I took a lot of what I learned from that movie and applied it to Au Pair. And I think that's why, you know, it was successful. And, you know, it was very well received. It got good reviews and good ratings. And, you know, people, the best compliment I usually get is they're like, this is like the best Lifetime movie I've ever seen. It almost feels like a real movie. I'm like, well, it's because we were trying to make one. My hope is, you know, when we made it, the hope was, oh, great, we'll have I'll have a directing sample, and we can start, you know, pushing me on to some of our screenwriting projects. But the pandemic just kind of topsy-turvied that plan. And I kind of doubled back into screenwriting because that's at the time what people were looking for from us. And now that that's kind of a little bit in our rearview mirror, you know, starting to look at what that next directing thing is going to be.
Oh, that's exciting. I'm happy for you.
Thank you. Yeah.
It seems like you know, I used to work for Gary Shandling, and he always used to talk about being on the path. Just stay on the path, keep your eyes on the path, walk the path. He was, of course, being Buddhist as well, but it just seems like you're really on a path with all of your work.
I hope so.
I have a question for you that I ask all my guests, especially because it's what I teach with the students in the Entertainment Business School. I talk a lot about finding your wolf pack, not lone wolfing it in this very relationships-based business. And you mentioned that you have a writing partner. So I would love to know from you, who's in your wolf pack, Joe?
Oh, man. We've got Hollywood is a funny town because you meet a lot of transactional friends. And I think when you do find the ones who go beyond being just business connects, and you actually genuinely connect with them on a personal level and a creative level, you kind of hold on to them as much as you can, you know? And those become the people that, you know, for my writing partner and I, who I've been writing with Chris for too long. we've been literally writing since I graduated from college, which was, I don't know if I want to care to admit that number anymore, but long enough. We found a lot of the people that we've genuinely connected with and we really trust on a creative level. Those are the people you call to get notes on your screenplay before you give it to your representatives. And, you know, those are the people that you're calling to vent and talk through the shitty notes you just got from a producer, or the, you know, the gruels of trying to cast a name actor for your movie so you can get your financing. Like, you need those people that you can really vent to and talk to. And then you'll realize when you talk to them that they're going through the exact same thing. And when you hear that, it makes you feel better. Even right now with meeting all these writers that I'm meeting for the first time on the picket line during the strike, knowing that we're all in this together, that we're all not working, that we're all not taking general meetings, that we're all not selling screenplays. There's something special about that, you know, relationship kind of, I think, being born in the fire, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been heartening seeing other people having a shared experience, I think, because sometimes all of that is really closely guarded. And it can be internalized, like, oh, if I didn't make that much money, it must be about me somehow. But then for everybody to come together and sort of say, well, we're all having this experience is really powerful in an industry where one of my friends likes to say, in this industry, you always have to be happy, busy, and pretty all the time. So who is it safe to be not happy, busy, and pretty with? I mean, those are my real friends and partners as well. It's like, can you know, who can you really be real with about what's actually happening? And that's a relief to be able to share the things that you do tend to keep more close to the vest.
Yeah, my wife tends to think that I overshare about some of the problems that I'm facing on projects, but I'd rather be honest about where I am in the creative process or the development process or the production process. I find the people who are like, oh yeah, everything's wonderful and great and blah, blah, blah. I don't believe them, you know, because I know that every movie is, can be like really draining and really hard. And so when they tell me that everything's flowers and candy, I just know that they're not being real with me.
They're full of shit, flowers and candy.
Yes, yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My son has recently fallen in love with horror. He's only 11, but I was telling him, I said, you know, you're in great company. They're some of the nicest people in the business, or the people who write horror and work in horror. They're like the greatest.
Honestly, it's true. You know, I've been producing a podcast of my own, which you mentioned at the top of the show, Postmortem with Mick Garris. And Mick himself is like genuinely regarded as like one of the nicest people in Hollywood, and it's true. And so he's been a great person to kind of just learn from and model myself after. But we've had over 150 guests on the show, and I would say there was like two who were not like who were rude or you know not friendly. Like and these are like the top of the top people that we've had. I mean, Guillermo del Toro, Stephen King, John Carpenter, like Jamie Lee Curtis, Karin Kusama. I mean, they've all been wonderful. We all joke that like, it's because all the horror people get it out on the page, or get it out and when they make the movie. And genuinely, that's why they're like, they're a little kinder and gentler than, some of the other creatives in town, but it really is like a wonderfully warm and open community, which has been great to kind of, you know, have stumbled into through my career.
That's so cool. I love that. My last question for you is going to be about breaking in, but I want to give everybody listening a little window into why I invited you to be on the show and how we had been chatting and connecting. Yeah. So I've been newly producing. My producing partner is Scott Gardenauer, and I'm reading a bazillion scripts for me and Scott. And Scott's unusual because he produced, you know, Armageddon and Pearl Harbor and a lot of Michael Bay's big movies. So he doesn't have the typical like budget restrictions that some of the producers do in the business. But that said, as I've been reading a lot of these scripts, even in Act One or even the first five pages, I'm going, oh my gosh, this writer just burned through millions of dollars in these opening scenes, you know, and I'm like, oh God, you know, how am I, this is this one that is it really worth it, you know, to position for Scott? And some of them are, and some of them really aren't, but it can be frustrating in terms of looking through all of that material, looking for great stories, great characters, and then realizing, okay, some of these writers have no idea what their own budgets are. They've gone to the limit of their imaginations, which is super fun. But I was venting about it on Twitter. It's never a wise thing to do to go to Twitter to vent, but I was I was on Twitter venting. I think I was on now.
No, that's because everyone, there's always someone who will disagree with you. And I
always,
maybe always. I feel like that's where we're heading. But I can't remember exactly. But
I remember what I said, but I was like, I'm tired, people.
Yeah.
And then you we were talking about breaking in, and you had dived into the thread and said, you know, it actually doesn't matter what the budget is of some of these scripts who are like pre-WGA and how they bust into the business. And what you had seen from your vantage point about writers breaking in, you had a couple stories about writers who had broken in with killer scripts. And I just was like, I'd love to hear your perspective. So that's why I invited you on the show.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, breaking in is obviously, that's like the great mystery, you know, and it's so glib to say like, oh, just write something great, right? But it really, like, it's that simple, and it's also that complicated, right? So yeah, I mean, I think you're not wrong. Like, it depends what you're looking for will determine what you're going to make. But that doesn't mean that the screenplay is not good, you know, like just because it's big, and maybe not producible for your producer that you're working with or your company, that doesn't mean that the writing's not good,
yes.
You know? And that doesn't mean that writer's not worth meeting with, you know? And I think when I first kind of realized that was in 2013, when I was still a development exec, there was a writer who's my age that, like, we became really chummy really quick. And, you know, I went to lunch with him, and we were talking about what he wanted to write next. And I said, you know, what if we did the true story about Saint Nicholas, you know, like the actual real historical guy, you know? And he's like, oh my God, I love that idea, blah, blah, blah. And he had all these like personal connections to the idea. And like, he'd like, his wheels were turning already, you know? And cause we were thinking like, oh, cool, we could do this big sword and sandals kind of religious epic, you know, the kind of movie that really doesn't get made anymore. But we could have the pre-branding of a character that literally everyone in the world knows, which is Santa Claus, right? And so we went off to start developing that script. And, you know, at the time he didn't have an agent, and that script got him his agent. And then that script got him on the blacklist, and that script, because it got on the blacklist, people were reading it over the holiday break. And when we came back, we had people calling us, we had incoming calls. And one of those incoming calls was MGM. And we sold it to MGM in their TV department. They wanted to expand it into a miniseries. And so that was like one of our, like for both of us, that was like our first big thing that we developed from the ground up and sold to a studio. And, you know, ultimately it didn't get made for a myriad of reasons, but like, you know, when he did the water bottle tour off of that thing originally, everyone looked at it and was like, this is too big, this is too expensive, but fuck, we love the writing. We love the character. We love the drama. We love the emotion, you know, it made them feel like they were reading Gladiator, but nobody could figure out how they could make it with, you know, make a Gladiator, right? The point being, it gave Leo a career, right? It got him his agent, it got him his manager, it got him on the blacklist, got him in front of every producer in town, you know, it got him money in his pocket. And even though it didn't happen, it opened the door for him to get his first movie made, which was one of those people that he met on that water bottle tour, right? They kept in touch with him. And when he took his next big sci-fi spec out, which everyone said you couldn't make, they said, we think we can. And they brought director Brad Peyton on, who's done a bunch of big movies like San Andreas. And they brought Brad Peyton in, and they sold it to Netflix. And it comes out in the next year. It's a Jennifer Lopez starring movie. You know?
Shit. That's rad.
Huge, right?
There you go. But,
you know, Leo's a guy who doesn't paint in small boxes. He's got big ideas, and he cannot be contained. But, you know, if he hadn't chased his passion for that storytelling that he has such affinity for, none of that might not have happened. You know, if he had tried to write into a little tiny box, none of that might not have happened.
That's such a good point. And it sounds like, in addition to being high concept, that the St. Nicholas spec was also, he executed well on that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like, it's not just about coming up with something high concept. It's about the characters inside of it, you know? And he had a really great handle on, you know, the classic kind of sword and sandals rise of a hero that he instilled into, you know, the story about a character that you've never heard before, right? So it was kind of just like the perfect combination of taking IP that you know, but doing a really interesting character point of view story through it.
Totally. Familiar but new. I just taught on that this week. Familiar but new. That's what we love.
That's right. That's what execs love. But even then, you know, like, you know, it was really hard. He sat down. I remember, you know, this was back when it was still kosher to meet with the Weinstein company, but he sat down with the Weinstein company for one of his first meetings. And they were like, we love this. This is amazing. It's one of the best scripts we've read all year, blah, 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 like showering him with praise. And it was one of the first general meetings Leo took. And he was like, well, then why don't you guys want to make it? You know, like it literally.
That's so innocent.
Yeah, but it was so innocent. But you know, but like genuinely, it's a great question because you go to these general meetings and they, you know, blow a bunch of smoke up your ass about how great your script is, but they passed on it. You know? So, but you know, the reality is there's two things a script can do for you. One is it could get made and become a movie. The other is it can be a great writing sample that gets you in front of the person who then helps get a different movie made for you.
Yes.
And I think that's really where, you know, the schism when we were talking on Twitter, that's where I was breaking off was, you know, I don't think you should just write to a specific low budget contained box because that's what's producible. I think you have to write what's in your heart. And that is ultimately going to serve you, I think, better than trying to chase a trend or check some boxes.
Right. What's in your heart? I love that. Joe Russo, where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at Joe Russo Tweets, and I am on Instagram at Joe Russo Graham.
Thanks so much for being a special guest on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Hollywood Wolfpack. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Please help our pack grow by sharing Hollywood Wolfpack with your friends and colleagues. Give us a rating and write us a review. Kaya loves hearing from you and reads them all. For more on Kaya and the Entertainment Business School, visit entertainmentbusinessleague.com. Until next week, remember, the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack.